and welcome to the Pocket Gamer Podcast. It's episode number 485. My name is James Gilmore, and joining me today is Dan Sullivan.
Hello.
No, Matthew, this week we are recording this a day earlier than we usually do, because I am going to be disappearing halfway through tomorrow to go and do Seattle-based stuff next week, as you mentioned last week. So Dan was good enough to block out some time from the old schedule. Yeah, I should mention that I'm drunk.
It's a qualifier to actually be on the podcast.
As we're a little bit early, that means that we don't have quite as many things like new releases. To be fair, most of them have come out, but sometimes things just pop up on a Friday morning that we're not expecting. So naturally, I'm sure all the best games will be announced the moment I press stop on my recording here. But don't worry, we've still got tons of stuff to keep you up to date with. For example, the arrival of Dead Cells over on mobile, iOS and Android. We've got the new Google smartphones, the Pixel 3a and 3a XL budget versions, an affordable way to get in on the Google handsets. We've got Gameloft and Microsoft pairing up for Xbox Live functionality, plus a whole bunch of new releases, including the likes of Jump Grid, Daggerhood, Tabletop Racing, and more. But first, the news. Didn't mention it in the preamble, but The Elder Scrolls Blades is actually out from its soft launch, beta phase, whatever you want to call it, this week. We're not putting it in the new releases section because A, we've already talked a load about this game on the show, and B, we're going to wait until we've got our man, I think Dave Aubrey is going to be doing the review because, as we were saying before, he's done a lot of playing of this game, and he's written novels worth of guides.
So many guides.
So whatever I say about this game is going to be redundant next to his opinion, because, you know, I've played a few hours and that's just nothing. But what I'm interested to see is if anything will have changed during that beta period, whether the feedback will have prompted them to make some adjustments. I feel like it made a bunch of money, which is...
Yeah.
Usually the sign that maybe they won't change a lot, but there was still the expected outcry about, oh, it's gone free to play and, you know, it's making you grind for ages. And to be fair, having played it, I share some of those complaints a bit. Did you get hands on it when it first started?
I didn't know. It was iOS initially, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I'm Android at the moment. So yeah, it means I miss out on everything, so...
But it's always a shame because I do the video stuff, obviously, and we get a lot of people complaining that this is yet another iOS game. Why aren't you covering Android? And the problem is a lot of stuff still comes to iOS first. And the reason we cover it when we do is because we cover the iOS stuff when it comes out. And then you'll see I link in the about section. I tend to put like TBC as in to be confirmed for Android, because inevitably it does come to Android.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a little bit of a gap. So... because we need to cover new releases, inevitably a lot of them come to iOS, and then it does become relevant, then it does appear on Android later. So we are doing both platforms. There's just always that stagger, that little delay between the two, which is still a bit of a shame. But if you've been waiting, because I know it was like an invite only beta thing, then you can all get involved now with the Elder Scrolls, and you can all be delighted / appalled at your leisure. So look forward to that.
And you don't need a Bethesda account to do it now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you don't need now. That was, I guess, just how they were monitoring who got in and whatever. I read somewhere that it still remains technically in an early access state, i.e. they're still planning on tweaking bits and bobs.
But
everything's early access and...
Yeah.
And games as a service and...
Yeah, the live service aspect of this, I think they're going to be changing and tweaking this as they go. So is it ever really finished? Is anything finished anymore? who knows? Well, we can talk about some stuff that is at least finite. I know, for example, that new Google phones are coming out and you'll be able to hold them in your hands and then they'll be done until the next update at least. So we're talking about the Pixel 3a and the Pixel 3a XL, which are... Google's attempt to pitch a more budget version of their Google Pixel devices, which came out, and the idea was they were going to be the premier Android handset in the same way that the iPhone is, you know, this luxury item, the idea that it has this sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Prestige attached to it. And they were going to try and do that for Android, which for me is like, something of a losing game a little bit, because I don't use Android for the prestige. I use it because I can get a cheap one.
That's
kind of the point of it for me. But there are those people who genuinely love Android and the Google Play Store and all that business. And so for them, having a dead sexy Pixel phone that costs, you know, £800 upwards, that's something that they want. However, that's a bit steep. So these ones, the 3A and 3XL, start at $399. And as a result of that, you are going to see a few hits and tweaks and little cuts from the form factor. So, for example, 3A's got the Snapdragon 670. So you're jumping down processors there a little bit from 845 to 670. The standard flagship ones have the, they now have those dual selfie cameras at the front if you're taking fancy pictures of yourself. It seems like so much has been put into the cameras now. I know that this is the same thing with the iPhones and the new iPhone Xs and stuff like that, where it's all about being able to do that very narrow focus thing. You got two cameras and you can mess about with it after the photo has been taken, as in adjust the focus. And basically they just realized that phones are selfie machines. That's what they're for now.
That's it.
This Pixel 3a doesn't have the dual selfie camera thing, but it does still keep the night light tech, which is a thing that lets you take good photos in low light and stuff like that. No wireless charging. I don't know how many people have adopted that, to be honest with you.
It's interesting technology.
It's handy just to be able to sling your phone on a spot and there you go. That is a nice idea. I think it's one of those things that will just take a little while to become the standard.
And then it'll be everywhere. It'll be, you'll go into a restaurant and put your phone down next to your plate and it'll charge while you're eating your grub.
Totally. I think that they're in cars as well. I think my wife's car's got one. Not that we have a wireless phone capable of charging that way, but I think it has the ability, if you put it in a certain place in the car, it'll kick in eventually.
Yeah.
Main thing here, though, is you'll see that the actual phone itself, very different body. So whereas the main Pixel, the Pixel 3, has, it's all glass and metal and whatnot, this is plastic. So they're obviously cutting down on costs there and sticking a 3.5mm headphone jack, which is, some people see as a backward step. A lot of people see as really, really good.
Yeah, that's like an upgrade. You can't just put that in a list of negatives, can you?
I know. I don't know if the... I have to check and see if the Pixel 3 doesn't have it and they've gone, you know, Bluetooth only. But a lot of people are still very happy to have a headphone jack option. Thanks very much. And as someone who 95% of the time uses Bluetooth headphones, I still end up, like, in the gym, I don't use Bluetooth because I don't want to wear the big over-the-ear ones because they get really hot, Dan. It gets hot.
Oh, yeah, and then you get, like, buckets of sweat contained within each. Yeah.
And that's gross. So I use little in-ear ones, and I find a lot of the Bluetooth in-ear ones don't stay in my ears properly, whereas the bog-standard rubbish ones that you get with, like, an iPhone or something, they work fine. So yeah. I like having the option of a 3.5mm jack. So, yeah, you can read the full spec list on the article that we put up if you want to, but even though this is, like, their budget option, starting at $400, so it's going to be £400 over here, still not that cheap.
No.
And the problem they're going to have is by reducing it to that price, they start putting it in the same category as other cheaper phones, but which offer maybe more at that price point. So, for example, you've got the Honor View 20, which is really, really quite good and has better specs and costs the same, if not a bit less. So, yeah, I'm curious to see if people sort of take this one on and run with the budget models or not.
It'll be a good test to see if the Google brand is enough to carry a device. People bought into the iPhone when it first launched, not just because it was new technology and it was refined and it was clean and it was approachable, but because of the Apple name.
Yes.
And that definitely gave it a good kickstart. And I feel like the first Pixel, when it launched, definitely benefited from Google's name. So I guess we'll see if it carries over into the budget ranges.
There's something about price as well. When you price something at 600, 700, 800, people go, ooh, I guess it must be good then.
True, yeah.
You know, this maybe doesn't have quite that clout, or at least you're putting it in competition with other things. It's funny how the inclusion of stuff automatically makes you think it's good. I often notice this on, like, cosmetic products, and you look at shampoo or something, and it says, contains 0% xenophylacylabate. And you go, good. Go, oh, great. Cool.
I hate that stuff.
Yeah. Awful. I'm so glad it's not there. And it's like, I've got no idea what that is. You look at all the things that they say now includes more. or 15% extra, whatever it is, and then now includes 0% this. Generally speaking, it's absolute, it's not like sodium or something you can easily identify. It's nonsense. But merely by the fact that it's mentioned on the box that there's more or less of it, you assume it must be good and or bad, depending on the context.
Yeah.
We just go, okay, I guess that's good then. And I think it's the same thing with price point. That's the prestige factor we're talking about. The iPhone, you know, comes out and they go £800. You go, ooh, it must be brilliant. And when you actually break it open and look at it, it's probably worth about a quarter of that.
Yeah.
But it's got an Apple on it, so people go mental. Anyway, speaking of branding, we've had Microsoft doing their Xbox Live thing in Minecraft over on mobile, iPhone and iPad and stuff like that. This is because Minecraft itself is owned by Microsoft, so they kind of built it into their own stuff, which is something that, generally speaking, I don't know, Apple might have problems with, because they like their walled garden and they don't like other people curating things or bringing their own tech necessarily, third-party tech, especially into their little ecosystem. However, Microsoft are now teaming up with Gameloft to bring Xbox Live into their mobile games.
Yeah, so this is quite interesting. So it was back in March, Microsoft announced that they were making the software development kit available for anybody to implement Xbox Live functionality into Switch games, Android and iOS games. But nobody kind of loudly stepped forwards.
No.
As sometimes, you know, sometimes it just doesn't happen. You get a little bit of a rumble in the room and then everybody just forgets that this thing existed for 5 or 6 years. But Gameloft came forward and they're putting it into 3 of their games. I can't remember the third one, but it the 2 most recent Asphalt games.
Asphalt games, and then I think it's Dragon Mania Legends?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
That's the third one.
Which are all current. They're all very current. They're very much the games that they've got up on a pedestal. All of their games point you towards those current products. All of their ads running are for those games. So it's interesting that they're pushing them in an update.
The thing that I'm curious about is what impact this has on the games, and also the directional change from Microsoft a little bit, as you point out. So in terms of what it will bring to the games, presumably the idea is you can import things like your friends lists, I guess. So it'll maybe allow you to see who else on your Xbox Live friends list is playing this game and maybe connect and use the multiplayer functionality. It's like a different way of finding friends.
I think that that's really going to be the core of it. The Xbox Live, because Microsoft were the first people to properly do an online system, we've got to ignore like the Dreamcast and the PlayStation 2 efforts because they just didn't quite carry it off. But Microsoft's Xbox Live really managed to get that community aspect and helped, I guess, pull games away from the couch into online multiplayer. So I think that the friends list, because they have a matchmaking system that they announced for the Xbox One that's all done through the cloud.
Okay.
As well. I'm not too sure whether that's still really a feature, but I'm pretty sure that games didn't necessarily have to sort out their own matchmaking. And so something like that could be quite useful as well.
Yeah, yeah. So that aspect of it will replace or be in addition to things like the old system, which was Game Center, for example, which is the system they've had built into iOS for eons now.
Yeah.
And also individual games setting up their own friends lists and leaderboards and multiplayer and all that kind of business. And you're right in the fact that it is still the biggest one, whereas Xbox has faltered this generation compared to the PS4, which has kind of emerged the clear winner here. You're right, in terms of online stuff and like accounts and whatnot, I think Xbox Live still reigns supreme because it was just there first. And during the 360 era, it really established itself, massive foothold on it all. And then their idea was, okay, we'll bring that over to the PC and we'll dominate the PC landscape as well, which I don't think quite worked out.
No, they need to give up this whole closed marketplace thing. Even if Epic managed to completely shatter Steam into 1,000 pieces, Microsoft will never really be able to roll out a storefront in the way that PC needs.
And so it feels like rather than trying to sort of dominate a particular platform, they've gone, all right then, well, we'll let our software infiltrate everyone else's platform.
Yeah, and just integrate into it. They've got so many great systems, such a great infrastructure, like their whole Azure cloud computing network, like how Google have this massive cloud computing network. That kind of stuff is really uncommon technology. There's less than a handful of companies that can do that. So why not leverage that with existing companies and existing properties rather than just trying to, you know, R&D your way to the forefront.
Yeah. And of course that, you know, I assume that tech also is going to be helping out with the Project xCloud system they've got going on, the streaming that they're going to be doing and trying to let you stream Xbox stuff onto mobile phones directly, which is, you know, presumably part of the reason they want to get Xbox Live onto mobile and
that's
get
it.
Mobile users accustomed to this idea of, hey, Xbox is on mobile, check it out. So yeah, we'll wait and see how the updates integrate and what it all looks like, but it's a first step towards something. I guess Minecraft was the first step, but
yeah,
once all these things kick into gear, a lot more Xbox on your phone. Very interested to see how that one turns out. Also, you've played this game, I haven't, but I kind of wanted to, and I guess now I'm going to get the chance. Dead Cells is coming to iOS and Android.
Oh, it's very good. It's very good, James.
Well, I heard that, but the problem is I don't have a Switch, really. I could have played it on PC, I suppose, but Switch was the big launch that came up recently, and everyone was delighted, and I am Switchless. But it's gonna be coming to my devices, which is very lovely. Now, my question is, how much of an impact do you think this is going to have? Having not played the games, I look at these old retro platformers, and I assume they are quite precision-based and pixel-perfect and all that. And that could be tricky to get right with your floaty touchscreen controls. What is Dead Cells like, and how do you think it'll translate?
So yeah, I agree. I think that controls are going to be like the biggest problem here, because I've got a bit of a busted thumb. One of my thumbs is off at like a 45 degree angle.
Okay.
From what I suppose would be like the midpoint, and so I can't properly click with my right thumb. So I sometimes have problems with mobile games. I sometimes have problems with consoles that have got small buttons on the right-hand side. So for me, the Switch, sometimes, because games like Dead Cells are so fast-paced, sometimes I just can't get to the buttons on time. And you very much end up blaming yourself when you fail in things like roguelikes, when the luck balance isn't quite right. So I don't quite know how the controls are going to carry over to mobile. But it's a very good game. I first played it probably about 3 years ago now, when they showcased the demo of it at the PC Gamer Weekender, back when that lot were doing those. And it's a fusion of like four or five different genres. At the time, they were calling it a Roguevania, I think, but they've now got a much longer title for it. But it's your normal roguelike fare, or roguelite fare, similar to stuff like Rogue Legacy, wherein you've got this big area that you're exploring, the rooms are all procedurally chunked together, and it's a platformer. The platforming isn't pixel precise. There's really no places in the game where you're going to be making a jump, and if you miss it, you're plummeting to your death, although there are some fall spots, and you do take fall damage as well. But the majority of the game is based around this very cool, slow-paced, almost like a dance combat, and the customization of your character. So like all enemies have tails, so it's a bit like a side-on fighting game, and everything feels a little bit weighty, even though you've got like dash moves and you can throw these grenades that'll freeze things, and there's all of these spells and weapons you can get. Everything feels a little bit like a rhythm game, because you're almost acting in a zen-like state. You familiarize yourself with your character setup and just push through. And there's a lot of persistence to it. There's a lot of kind of unlocking weapon blueprints. And then you very much start tailoring your character. It's hard to explain what makes Dead Cells stand out. It was just when something hits an existing genre's requirements, bang on the head, and then moves forwards in things like art design or sound design, it kind of sticks out and marks a new milestone for the genre, and Dead Cells very much did that.
Well, they've got a trailer of it running, so an announcement trailer, and mostly it just shows kind of captured gameplay, but there is a little bit of it superimposed onto a phone, and it gives a little hint towards what we're going to be dealing with in terms of the UI. So there are a little cluster of buttons in the lower right-hand corner, so it looks to me like you're going to have four different types of attack, and then maybe a standard weapon / button, for example, and maybe a jump button on the right hand side. So it is going to be standard floating buttons. I can't see the virtual stick on the left, but I'm sure there is one there. So they're doing it in the way that they generally do these things by the look of it. I'm glad to hear it's not like a Super Meat Boy level of precision or something, because that can prove problematic, as the Super Meat Boy folks themselves have found, where they went, we're never going to bring a version to mobile, because lol, as if it would work. Yeah. And then they spent ages working on one, actually. And then it still hasn't come out.
Yeah.
Release date-wise, we're talking, they've just said summer, right?
Yes, a vague summer, which could be next month, could be a couple of months. But but it was originally, it kind of let slip late last year when Playdigious put the app page live.
Okay.
So I guess they were already working on it back then. So I don't know how much porting effort it's required, but they've definitely been on it for a good 7 or so months now.
I'm just glad that we get to play it because I thought it was sweet, and I know it's another reason to buy a Switch, but still, just bring it to me. Bring it to my platform. No, this is what I like.
It raises a good point about games, ports, and that kind of tribal, like, no, I prefer this platform, because everybody plays games. Everybody wants to play the same games. And ultimately, because of how fast technology is moving on mobile gamers will very soon be able to play almost any game that comes out on anything else, as long as someone bothers to port it over. So it's the tribalness can really be set aside, because it's really just a case of which console you prefer or which medium you prefer to play the device on.
And it's a suitability thing. That's the thing, which is like some devices really do benefit certain genres. And there was a thought at the beginning when we were starting to play mobile games on touchscreens that, you know, platformers aren't going to work very well. You can't do it. And then as of said before, like podcasts years ago, you end up with things like League of Evil and other games from folks like Ravenous Games particularly are really good at doing them. They prove that actually you can do precision platformers and make them work on a touchscreen, which seemed unlikely, but no, they can do it. So this is very, very promising. I will definitely be grabbing hold of this whenever we can. But yeah, Dead Cells, summer, iOS, Android, keep your eyes peeled. Out and about this week, I'm going to start with Jump Grid, which I've already done the review for in video form, and it'll be scheduled to go up a little bit later while I'm away. But this speaks to me, Dan, because I am a big fan of the minimalist, lo-fi, retro, speedy puzzler things, especially on mobile. One of my favorite games is Super Hexagon. Jump Grid sort of falls into the same camp. It's more complicated than that, but it is still a simple, touch-based, very high-speed retro puzzler. The idea is this plays out on a grid. Usually it is a sort of noughts and crosses style grid where you have 9 intersecting points. So if you just imagine a square made up of 4 smaller squares, you've got a top left corner, then a middle, and then a right corner. And you're tapping left and right to jump your little glowing orb thing between these 9 dots, 3 horizontally, 3 vertically, and then across the middle. And the idea is on each of these 9 points, there is a floating cube, and you need to collect all 9. Once you've collected all 9, a little warp opens up in the middle of the cube, and then you can jump to that center point, and boom, level completed. Problem is, the game is throwing loads of stuff at you while you're doing it. So it is throwing what look like bits of computer chips are kind of zooming in and moving out of the screen. You've got weird fluctuations that look like a spectrum loading bar or something. You know, this multicolored flickering that went out the side of a Spectrum 128K when you were loading it up. Kids, you will have no idea what I'm talking about, but
it's a good thing Matt's not here.
I know. If you're old enough, if it's pre-N64, he hasn't got a clue. But that lasery beams flying across, just loads and loads of rotating, undulating, gyroscoping obstacles are moving around the screen. So you need to jump your little blip around to try and avoid them as they're moving. Problem is, these things will move across the entire grid. So there's no way you can just run away into a corner, because it will just follow you, and then as soon as it makes contact and passes you, you're dead. So you need to start realizing, hey, once you get to the full left-hand side of the grid, if you swipe left again, you will warp over to the right-hand side of the grid. You kind of go off one side of the screen and emerge in the other. So you need to use that to kind of outwit the stuff that's being thrown at you. You also realize you can jump over certain obstacles. So when solid bits of matter are kind of flying towards you, then provided it's in the middle of 2 nodes and you're on the lower node, you can actually jump over it onto the node above. It's best explained visually, clearly, but it's fantastically good fun. It's really, really fast. When you do the levels correctly, they're over in like under 10 seconds.
Yeah.
But you are having to consider so much during that time, because they constantly change on you. The obstacles are constantly changing. Each new level, each new zone is, okay, different bits are flying at you, different shaped laser beams or different shaped blocks of chipboard are flying at you at different times. So you need to learn that. And then when you move on to the second set of stages where the screen goes blue, suddenly things are kind of more curved and you have other objects that move in different ways. Then when you get to like a red zone later on, the grid itself, the background of the screen starts to move, starts to undulate backwards and forwards while other objects in the foreground are moving. So it gets more and more and more complicated, but it maintains this incredibly high speed, incredibly pacey, heart in your throat, you need to make the decisions in a microsecond kind of gameplay. And it's really good. Really good fun, really suits the touchscreen incredibly well because you just swipe, 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 swipe. I never felt betrayed by the controls. Any of the split second decisions were, you know, effectively responded to by the game. If I died, it was my fault and I couldn't blame lag or anything like that. So
it's always good.
Very good, yeah. It's out on Steam, I think, as well. So it's
I'm looking at the Steam page and yeah, the art style, you mentioned the kind of microchip.
Yeah.
Style textures on it. The whole thing looks amazing.
Yeah, it's a bit Super Hexagon. It's a bit like, I don't know, Lo-Fi Tron or something. But it's a cracking wee thing. It'll be a premium game when it comes out. I'm not 100% sure on the price point on mobile because it's not technically live yet as we record this. But check out the video review when it's up and Harry's review. I think it's really strong stuff. And, you know, if you're not a fan of free-to-play things and you like minimal puzzlers that really get you stressed, this is ideal. So Jump Grid is the name of that one. Go and check that one out. Another game that is inviting stress onto your phone is Daggerhood, which I've played a couple of hours of, and I think you've played some as well, Dan, but on PC.
On Xbox.
Oh, actually. Xbox, okay.
Yeah, slightly earlier on in the year it launched there. It's quite good, but we were talking about pixel platformers earlier, and it's very much one of those, isn't it? Especially if you want 100% it.
It demands precision. So how would you describe this one?
Just a really fast-paced sequence of platforming levels with kind of four or five collectibles, including one time-based one, on every level. There's about 20, 25 levels to each world, which then culminates in a boss chasing you down that you've got to evade in time. Some really nice artwork in it. I really like the colour schemes that they've chosen. The audio's got that really cool echoey effect on it that I always instantly think back to this game that kind of haunted my childhood, which was Shadowgate on the NES.
Okay.
And it just had this echoey effect. But I really like the sound effect. I don't think there's much that really stands out about it.
Well, the thing that makes it slightly different, I guess, is the dagger that's mentioned in the title. So the idea is, you know, side-scrolling retro platformer, like Dan says. At first glance, it looks very similar to all that old 16-bit stuff.
Yeah.
But there are, you know, a few differences. The animation's a little bit slicker. Your little lead character, the way he moves, his kind of idle animation is very, very nicely done. But the way that you attack is you throw a dagger. So you two buttons, one for jumping and then one for attacking. But you throw out a dagger and it moves, you know, not super fast across the screen and it strikes enemies. However, the idea is when you jump and you throw that dagger out, if you then tap the dagger button again, the fire button, you will teleport to wherever that dagger is and suddenly, boom, jump onto the floor. So that then becomes a key component in the way that the levels are designed, and they're all built around this puzzle mechanic where there are levels or bits of the level that are completely inaccessible. So there are a series of spikes across the ceiling and the floor, and there's no way you can jump through. So you have to jump up, throw the dagger, wait till it passes and reaches the platform, and then exactly the right moment, hit the fire button again, and bam, that'll teleport you to that location.
And you're also using this weapon to, if you choose to, fight off the enemies as well.
Yeah, because it is an offensive thing.
And so it's quite interesting, but you have to avoid that muscle memory of pressing the button to swap places with the weapon when you're using it to target an enemy. Because, like, more than a couple of times, having got through these narrow sequences of dodging spikes and landing on sliding platforms, etc., I've gone to throw the dagger at an enemy and I've hit the button thinking, oh, it's there, it's now is the right moment, and then obviously teleported myself into the enemy rather than killing it. So
yes, you have that problem where we're programmed, especially with, like, you know, firing based games, anything's gun to go fire, 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 fire.
That's
and
it,
here
yeah.
That is catastrophic because the moment you press it a second time, you've teleported into some spikes. So you have to be very cautious and careful about when you use it. And it's one of these games that requires a lot of planning because One hit is death, and so you get used to restarting the level and then plotting your route through the level. As Dan said, there's the 5 different collectibles you can get, but there's also this fairy who pops up, much like those weird little goblin scuttling things in Dark Souls and Bloodborne, where occasionally you walk into the room and you see it in the corner and then it scuttles off. And if you chase it down and smash it, then you get lovely, lovely things. But if it runs out the corner, that's it. You can't get it back. And the fairy's kind of on a timer. So you need to find her and reach a certain point in the level, but she will blink out after, 10, 15 seconds. So you need to get there quick, which again means, right, restart the level, plan how you get there and all of that. So in a lot of ways, it's very traditional, standard retro platformer, but it is a nice hook with that throwing dagger. It does add an extra element, and it's a very well-presented version of this kind of game. So difficulty spikes, notwithstanding, Daggerhood, about a 7 out of 10, I think we gave it. Pretty strong stuff. I think it's premium. You can chase that one down on iPhone, iPad, and Android, I think. If it's not out right now, it will be definitely there very, very soon. You've got a Switch, right?
I have indeed, yep.
Yeah, you and Matthew do the Switch stuff. I don't, but Tabletop Racing World Tour Nitro Edition appeared on Switch, which is another kart racing style game, this time done in Micro Machines style. So there are all these little shrunken down little cars racing around larger than life landscapes. So you're running around on people's tables and on floors and that kind of thing. The reason this is interesting is because this came out, or at least a version of this game came out on mobile in 2014. It's a rare instance of mobile ports coming over onto Switch. There have been quite a few recently, actually, to be fair.
There has, yeah.
It's happening more and more now. But so this came out ages ago and was okay when it came out. It was a Micro Machines style thing and it was fairly decent. This one's got a lot of suffix added to it because before it was just tabletop racing and now it's World Tour, Nitro Edition, yada yada. But it's pretty much the same deal. So little single player campaign, which is fairly interesting. Lots of different types of races to tackle. So you get drift races if you want to, and time trials, elimination rounds, all the stuff you'd expect in competitive multiplayer stuff. You've even got 2-player split screen, which is quite nice, but it's kind of okay, is what we've heard. I don't know if you've played either version of it. You said it looked familiar, but that might just be because it's another kart.
Yeah, there was a kind of big surge, wasn't there, where everyone had been egging on Codemasters for so long to just make a new Micro Machines that a bunch of developers like Milkstone and a few others just went, right, well, actually, we're just going to make our own.
Yeah.
And so I'm pretty sure there was like a summer where there were about 6 releases of these like games where you're racing around kitchen tabletops and stuff. And I can't quite place if this is one of the ones that I played.
And eventually Codemasters did do their proper Micro Machines on mobile, which was okay. I think it was a bit free to play-y. Problem is those games, and I haven't played the originals for such a long time. I don't know if it's one of those rose-tinted glasses things where I remember them as being just fantastic fun. But maybe if I revisited them, they wouldn't be. I don't know if they stand up.
I think it's one of those. Yeah, I think the glasses definitely help. I went to a little event up in London. The guy who came up with, I think it's Steve McNeil, the guy who came up with Go 8-Bit, which was on Dave. He runs a little event in a pub up in London, and they have a couple of comedians come in. They do stand-ups, and then they play games against each other, and all of the audience log into the Wi-Fi and can play games on their phones as well, and everyone bets on who wants to win. And they had Micro Machines there, and yeah, when you see two people who aren't necessarily that great at playing it, a lot of it's just remembering the good bits. So it's definitely so it's definitely rose-tinted glasses.
I suddenly feel compelled to dig out an Amiga now and have a go, because I wouldn't play on an Amiga. The one true console. Or computer, really, not a console.
I lived above one of the, when I was a wee lad, I lived above one of the guys who worked remotely for Codemasters.
Oh, yeah?
And he worked on one of the Micro Machines. And I remember one of my earliest gaming memories is going downstairs into his flat and playing Micro Machines on his computer and him just talking in this dull monotone voice saying how like he did the coding on this bit and this and this. And yeah, so I've always had a soft spot for Micro Machines.
It's a nice way into the idea that, hey, people make games, by the way.
Yeah,
they
don't
just appear when you know them. My version of that is that I lived in Bournemouth when I came down here when I was younger, and Andy, the guy who came up with Worms.
Oh yeah.
He ran, or co-ran, worked in a shop called Caltech, which was then a Commodore store. There was an actual little Commodore shop they had. And he was making Worms at the time. So we were all playtesting Worms, which was at the time called Total Wormage, which they changed for obvious reasons. But, you know, that was a thing that was made for Amiga on Amigas, you know. And then eventually it became this mammoth franchise. And yeah. I think he got taken for a bit of a ride with it, to be honest with you, where they like bought the IP and then he got not much off the back end after that. So while it's continued to make a ton of cash, he hasn't, which is very, very sad. But that was another example of like seeing someone making a little thing and then suddenly it's out in the world and it's this huge, real thing that everyone is playing.
That's it.
And you're like, wow, this can happen. This is how games are made. Incredible. But yeah, so this one got a 3 stars out of 5, so 6 out of 10 from John Monday when he reviewed it, which was early last week. And yeah, you can get it right now for Switch. Tabletop Racing World Tour Nitro Edition is the name. We've also got a couple of things that were reviewed that came out last week. So Spellforce Heroes and Magic came out. I'm not familiar with the Spellforce franchise.
I really like the franchise. I have a feeling from what I've seen about this, it's not similar. Because the Spellforce franchise, what it was is it was kind of like a part action RPG. Mm-hmm. And then you'd reach certain points and like the camera would pull out and you still had your character. It's just now they were like a hero unit and you were base building and building infantry units and units to then go and attack. But okay. Still with your hero unit. Although a few years ago, THQ Nordic picked up the IP because they've done that for everything that hasn't moved for more than 5 minutes now. Mm. And they launched one that was more like a kind of Baldur's Gate style, 6-person party, go off on adventures style thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is more like turn-based battling, hex-based sort of RTS stuff.
Okay.
And apparently not a great version of it. So I haven't actually played this one, but we had our review done by Matt Thrower did this, who's our primary strategy guy. And he says, yeah, battle mode, you get like escalating fights against these one-off foes. They're pretty small maps and it's all turn-based. It's very, very unconvincing with the onboarding. So you get occasional tooltips, but not a real tutorial. And you have to just sort of work out what's going on, which I generally like. But the problem is this is supposed to be a strategy game and that these games need to be explained a bit. This isn't just like a context-based stuff. There are loads of icons and logos that need to be explained and apparently it's not really done.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, done that well. So fixed phases where you go like missile fire happens before movement, then attacking. So, you know, standard turn-based strategy stuff. But ultimately, it feels a bit unfinished, not particularly entertaining. There's loads and loads of trial and error and stuff that just doesn't work great. So read his full review. I'm only reporting through him because I haven't played it, but not the greatest thing. So Spellforce Heroes and Magic review is the name of that one. I think I'll do for this week. We will catch up with anything that appears tomorrow, like on a future podcast. I have a feeling we won't be putting one out next week because I will be on a plane on Friday afternoon coming back. So I think there will be a gap next week, warn you in advance of the podcast, but we will definitely be back the week after with more mobile gaming newsy stuff. Thanks for coming on with me today, Dan.
Never a problem.
And thank you all for listening. Like, subscribe, bear with us through the drought next week, and we will see you in a couple of weeks' time with more. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Bye.